Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. It's been a helter-skelter first parliamentary week of the year, including for our podcasts. We've already brought to you interviews with government and opposition front benches. And today we're speaking to one of the key Senate crossbenchers. Independent Senator Nick Xenophon has always been a hyperactive player. Now he's stepping up to a new level, starting his own party called the Nick Xenophon Team and planning to field a party of candidates nationally for the election. As the Palmer United Party collapses, Senator Xenophon will hope to translate some of his enormous personal popularity – he got nearly two quotas at the election – into extra crossbench power. Nick Xenophon, your plan to go national is extremely ambitious and quite risky. You're a household name in South Australia, but less well known elsewhere. What made you do it?
Because I think people want a genuine choice from the political centre. I think they're sick of the left and right skirmishes we see in politics, the red team, blue team approach, where even if one side acknowledges that the other side has a good idea, it needs to tear it down by virtue of this combatant nature of Australian politics. And I think that there is a vacuum for the political centre, that bridge between the left and the right, where you genuinely seek the best solution to the nation's problems. It is very ambitious, it is risky, and I should hasten to add that I don't like it being under my name, Nick Xenophon Team, but the decision was made that to call it anything else would have cost a fortune in terms of rebranding, for want of a better word. And after the next election, I hope, depending on the success of the team, I'm hoping that it will be called something else.
Can you tell us something of what's been put into place? How many states will you be running in? Will you be selective in what lower house seats your team's contesting? For example, I think there's a candidate against Tony Abbott. What's the purpose of that, given that there's no chance of electing anyone there?
Well, Michelle, in terms of the seat of Warringah, Marie Rowland is running that seat. She's a local. She wanted to run. She is very highly regarded as a councillor. She runs her own small counselling business where she's very highly regarded, deals with mental health and youth issues. I think she made the point on the day that her campaign was launched that she may not be a triathlete, but she'll give Tony Abbott a run for his money. And I think the people of Warringah deserve a choice. So I wouldn't write her off quite yet. Look, in terms generally, there will be candidates in every state, Senate candidates in every state. And there's been a very exhaustive and deliberative process over the last 12 months, choosing candidates, going through a very strong process where people get to know each other, answer the questions, the various background checks and the like. And there will be candidates in a number of lower house seats. Obviously in South Australia, at this stage, 8 seats will be contested. I expect it will be, if not all 11 seats, it will be close to all 11 seats will be contested by the election. A number of candidates are up and running. 2 candidates in lower house seats in Queensland, 4 in New South Wales, 1 in Victoria. And, you know, these are candidates who have strong views about the local community, want to give people an alternative, and they ought to be given an opportunity to have a go and to give voters that choice.
What's the structure? Who, for example, has done the pre-selections?
Well, the pre-selections, and there's a process that's on the website, the nxt.org.au website, and the process is that people apply, they go through a series of questionnaires, of meetings, people getting to know each other, people making presentations in terms of their ability to communicate. And there were 450 people that put their hand up initially back in December 2014. And can I say the quality, the standard of candidates was very high overall. And we've now gone down to some 30 candidates nationally. And it was a case of choosing the best of the best in terms of going through that process.
Is there an executive that is of candidates chosen by them?
Sure. There are electoral advisory committees in each state where they work together, they work on ideas and in terms of campaigning. But ultimately, it's a decision by the executive that comprises of me, of Sterling Griff, my campaign manager, who was my running mate at the last Senate election, who just missed out. And John Darley is also part of that executive committee. He's an MLC, a member of the Legislative Council from the South Australian Parliament, who was elected on that ticket. And John has a very eminent background as a senior public servant in South Australia, being a former Valuer General and former head of a government department.
And where's the money for the campaign coming from?
That is a very good question. It is running on pretty much a shoestring budget. I like saying it's a dental floss budget rather than a shoestring budget. We've had one large donation, which we disclosed up front before we had to under election disclosure
from
laws.
From who?
Largely from Ian Melrose, who runs Optical Superstores, or who's part of Ian and Margaret Melrose. They run a number of companies. They're the largest Australian-owned optical dispensers in the country.
And they've been involved in other campaigns.
They have, on human rights issues. I've known Ian for many years, and we share similar views and values on issues related to East Timor and a whole, and he's got similar views on gambling and also on Australian Made. I think that fact is Ian Morrow's proudly is located in Australia. They don't have a tax haven to go to, unlike some of their competitors. I'm very pleased to be associated with
him. What was the size of the donation?
$100,000.
But you're going to need a lot more than that.
Yes, we will. And it's just, I've got to say, I'm a lousy fundraiser, and I would rather have lots of small donations. If there were $1,100 donations or a couple hundred dollar donations, that would go a long way. Obviously, I put some of my own money in it in terms of taking out a loan, but I fully expect to get most, if not all, of that money back when public funding comes through after the election campaign.
This is inevitably going to be a very leader-centred effort because it is based on your name. It'll be an enormous job to canvass the country, won't it?
It is an enormous job, and I went around the country at my expense, or the political party's expense, recently, where I think it was, just about every capital city in the course of 7 days. It's pretty hard yards, and of course I fly economy, Michelle, as you know, and stay in budget accommodation. It is a big...
Perhaps a swag out in the bush.
Swags are good. The last time I did a swag was in Minterby in far north of South Australia about 25 years ago, 30 years ago, I need to do it again. It is a big ask. It is ambitious, but I think it's important that I give this a go. I think it's important to give people that choice. And I think the exercise has been extremely worthwhile because there are some incredibly good people who've come forward. All of them have been really good people who otherwise wouldn't have been involved in politics, who wouldn't have put their hands up, because they feel that this is an opportunity not to be locked in that left-right dichotomy of Australian politics.
Realistically, obviously South Australia would be the place where you might have an outside chance of a lower house seat. Do you think you're running either Christopher Pyne or Jamie Briggs close in their seats?
Well, look, we'll wait and see. All I can tell you is that there was a Reach Tell poll done several weeks ago by the Seven Network, which showed the Nick Xenophon team candidate, Rebecca Sharkey, who used to work for Mr. Briggs a number of years ago, who is a very dynamic candidate, a woman in her early 40s with three kids and a husband who's very supportive of her. She will give Jamie Briggs a real run for his money. The poll showed that she was just below Labor's vote. She was in about 16%. The Reach Tell analysis was that another 2% she would leapfrog Labor and, with preferences, have a real chance of winning that seat.
How many Senate seats do you think you can win? Now, you're not up for re-election in South Australia this time, so yes. Given that you had nearly two quotas last time, you should be in line in an ordinary Senate election for a quota for your candidate. So that would give you yourself and at least one other person in the Senate.
And I'm really hoping that Sterling Griff joins me after the next election. He's a lead Senate candidate. It depends whether there's a double dissolution or not. Look, there are strong candidates in every state, and also in a state such as Tasmania. Michelle Holt is running there with Nicholas Cohen, who's her running mate. you just don't know what will happen in those smaller states. But also in Queensland, Suzanne Grant is the lead Senate candidate, and she is putting a lot of dynamism and effort in her campaign. Candidates in New South Wales, Western Australia, and Victoria, Naomi Halpin has been an advocate for victims of financial fraud, financial crime, and outspoken on that. And I think that she has her own following that she'll bring with her to this campaign.
Is the aim of this whole exercise to get a substantial slice of the Senate balance of power when at the moment you have a very small slice?
The aim is to give people representation from that political centre, from that political vacuum that I don't think is being filled. So it depends on Senate voting reform. I just want people to be fairly represented, and if we...
Well, that means getting more people in.
That's right, and that's right. And it is a big ask, but I think that there is a combination of good policies, really good candidates, and the will to actually give this a go. We don't have the money of the major parties or even the minor parties, let alone the money that Clive Palmer had to splash around at the last federal election. But I think we do have a message that resonates with people in the community, whether it's on predatory gambling, on Australian made in terms of Australian jobs, in terms of local procurement policies, and also generally about government transparency and accountability.
Turning now to some specific issues, the Senate report on the Chinese lease of the Port of Darwin, I think, comes out very soon. And we also soon expect a decision on the recalibrated Chinese bid for the huge, or part of the huge, Kidman Empire,
yes,
pastoral empire, a pared down amount from last time, but nevertheless still a very large amount. You've had concerns about these investments. What do you see as the problems?
Well, in relation to the Port of Darwin lease, it seems extraordinary that it took the US President Barack Obama to raise it with our Prime Minister at a summit, because it seems that the only way we found out about it, or he found, the US President found out about it, was through the Wall Street Journal, or here in Australia through the Northern Territory News.
I think he was told he should read the Northern Territory News.
Yes, and
wasn't he?
and it's a great publication, the Northern Territory News, but I'm not sure if it's on the reading list of the US President. But the point there is that here is a major strategic port where I don't think national interest and national security considerations were given due weight, because under our current foreign investment review framework, a state or territory's assets are exempt from appropriate levels of scrutiny. They effectively are waived through unless it's a state-owned enterprise. So I think there are legitimate questions here. I mean, all I ask for in our foreign investment review framework is for the Australian government to take into account the national interest of Australians in the same way the US government looks after the national interests of its citizens, or the Chinese government looks after the interests of its citizens in that country. And if an Australian or an American or any other country wanted to buy, for instance, or lease the Port of Shanghai, I would suggest to them good luck to them, because there's no way that the Chinese government would approve a strategic port being sold to a, or leased to a foreign entity.
And the Kidman land, they're stripping out the part that overlaps with Woomera, so the security concerns are now gone.
Yes, but there are some other concerns, and this is also relates to the VDL, the Van Diemen's Land dairy property, the biggest dairy, not in Australia, but in Australasia, is situated in Tasmania. And I wrote to the Treasurer about this recently, to Scott Morrison, where I suggested that in relation to the Kidman property that he ought to take into account any credible alternative Australian bids. And I understand that Lindsay Fox's company is interested in making a bid. Now, if there is a credible Australian bid for a significant piece of our primary agricultural land, then I think that ought to be taken into account. Because after all, our foreign investment laws are meant to be there to facilitate investment where local investment is not forthcoming.
The GST's been consuming the political debate here in Canberra this week. What is your view about a GST rise?
I don't support it for a number of reasons. Firstly, it is a regressive tax. Secondly, before we even think about putting up the GST, let's see what revenue we can obtain fairly from multinational corporations that appear to be paying less tax in the cents in the dollar in tax than the average wage earner. Let's also look at issues of superannuation tax breaks, which are consuming an ever increasing amount of revenue or tax in terms of eroding the tax base. A very careful and calibrated tweaking of negative gearing, as recommended by Ken Henry, perhaps could go a long way as well. And also the flip side of that is that I think state governments and the federal government and local governments need to get their house in order in terms of the efficient delivery of services. So let's tackle that first before we talk about increasing the GST.
Malcolm Turnbull this week raised the threat of a double dissolution if the Senate knocks back the legislation to re-establish the Australian Building and Construction Commission. At the moment, the bill looks doomed. What's your attitude to it? And would it have a better chance now that Minister Cash has said she's willing to put a sunset clause on it?
Look, I'm not sure whether the sunset clause would make a difference. Clearly, that may affect some wavering parties. I supported the second reading stages of the ABCC when it was last before the Parliament. That basically means that you support that first stage of the bill, if you like, being further debated and for there to be a committee stage and amendments to be moved to see what would arise out of that, whether I support the final stages, the third reading stages of the bill. I think there are genuine and serious problems on building sites. I think there is a need for a tough but fair cop on the beat, so to speak. But I also acknowledge the role of unions in terms of occupational health and safety. I don't want to see unionists being jailed or being heavily fined for doing their job to ensure a safe workplace. And they do have a very strong and legitimate and proactive role there. So, and also broadly, I think we need to look at whistleblower protection laws. If we're concerned about corruption in unions, we should also be concerned about corporate malfeasance and problems within government where there is waste and where there are bad decisions made. And our whistleblower laws are important. We need to look at the US system where whistleblowers can be compensated for coming forward. And I say that in the context of we have these royal commissions. I wonder whether they would have been necessary or as necessary if whistleblowers were protected in the first place to prevent these problems from festering.
The bill has gone to a Senate committee now, hasn't it?
It has.
And so these things will be explored
well,
then?
Well, look, they were previously explored. I voted initially with the government today on a procedural motion because I thought it was fair enough for there to be a two-week inquiry to report back in 2 weeks' time so that it wouldn't unduly delay the consideration of the bill. The Senate has an important role to do. The Senate committee system is important. But this is identical to the bill that was brought up last year. This is identical to legislation that's been around a long time that has already been subject to a Senate committee inquiry.
Isn't the inquiry a bit longer than that?
Yes, it is. Well, that was the procedural tactic. And I understand why the ALP and the Greens and some of my crossbench colleagues want to put this bill off to the never-never. But in terms of a reasonable approach, I thought it was reasonable to allow a short, sharp inquiry of a couple of weeks, given that this is identical to the bill that was previously the subject of an inquiry.
Do you think there will be a double dissolution?
Michelle, there's only one person that knows that, and that is Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, and I'm not sure that he's decided what he's going to do yet.
It would be good for your new party, wouldn't it? Smaller Senate quota and...
Well, it will mean a smaller Senate quota, so when the government says that They're holding it over the Senate or minor party and crossbench senators by threatening a double dissolution election. I don't quite get that because I think the government's putting a gun to its own head rather than to the heads of crossbench senators.
Well, of course, that the bullets in that gun will be affected or would be affected if there were a double dissolution, if there was reform of the Senate voting system. You've been an advocate of that reform.
Yes, I have, and my position's evolved on that. I mean, I think that there ought to be a situation where you get rid of those preference whispering, those backroom deals, which I think are anomalous. The voting for a senator should not be like buying a lottery ticket, because that's what it's become. And that's not to be critical of any of my colleagues on the crossbench, all of whom I respect. And, Ricky Muir, one of the newer senators there, has really shown himself to do exemplary work and has been a terrific contribution, made a terrific contribution to the Senate, one of many. I think that the fairest system would be to say voters are required to put at least six numbers above the line, which means that voters will have to consider, other than a major party, if they're a major party voter, as two-thirds are, they will need to think of alternative choices, minor parties, micro parties, independents, and to have at least 12 marked below the line, which would cover the situation of double dissolution. And it will then put the power back to the voters, but still require voters to seriously consider alternative choices other than the major parties.
And finally, do you think this will happen before the election?
Look, it's up to the government. I would like to think that the government will seriously consider this. To me, that to me is the best position that would be fair to voters. It will be fair to my crossbench colleagues. And above all, it will get rid of the gaming of the current Senate system with the group voting tickets, where, Michelle, I guarantee you that I think that 99% of voters have no idea where their preferences end up. 99% of voters will not be aware that in South Australia, for instance, the Labor Party, the Australian Labor Party, helped get Bob Day from Family First, who's a terrific bloke, very successful home builder, respect his, you know, acumen, don't agree with him ideologically on most issues. But he's someone who is to the right of the Liberal Party. He got elected on Labor Party preferences ahead of my running mate, Sterling Griff, who is firmly from the political centre. So go figure.
Nick Xenophon, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all from this Conversation podcast. Thanks to my producer, Pat Hutchins, and we'll be back again soon.